Good afternoon, party people, and welcome to Office Hours, doing a live one on Twitch, going through your questions over from polgab.com/room/Brento. I am in Las Vegas, back at home at Las Vegas for probably about the next month, month and a half. Was on the road traveling a whole lot, picking up the various sports cars from all over the western U.S. Now everything's here in Las Vegas, and now I'm going through home renovations. I'm going through just doing the master bedroom closet. Next up is the kitchen, redoing the kitchen with new cabinets, countertops, and all that. I'm in a 20-year-old house, which doesn't sound all that old, especially for folks not in America. 20 years doesn't sound like that much, but like a builder-grade house with 20-year-old stuff is... kind of sketchy, hit or miss here. Like, I have to close my dishwasher with two hands. I can't just use one hand to close the dishwasher. I have to like jam the whole thing closed. Makes all kinds of noise. So let's go through and see. And I've tried, I've got an appliance warranty, and they're not doing anything about that either. So let's go through and see what your questions are over at PollGab, the number one highest rate. Oh, hey, I use lowercase for select. The number one highest rated question is from Chandwich, who asks, "Hi, Brent. I've been unsuccessful in my attempt to convince my employer that I need formal SQL training." That's because your employer thinks you're so sharp. "I help manage hundreds of customer SQL servers and applications." Okay, so now that's interesting that you're managing customers' SQL servers and applications. That makes it sound like your company is billing for your time. I'm not positive for that. You didn't say you're a consultant, but it sounds that way. "They refuse to pay for my training. Should I leave? Should I just pay for it myself? Any advice?" So if you are a consultant and your company is billing for your time, the first way that I would approach that is, would I be more valuable to you if I was better at my job? Would I be more valuable to you, my manager, if I was better at my job? And if the answer is no, that's kind of a ticking time bomb for your career, too. That tells you that you're probably not going to get any better in terms of raises, finance, you know, better job responsibilities, or whatever, depending on how much you do. Now, there can be times in your life where you're okay making that compromise, going, okay, I'm in kind of a dead-end job, but the money's really good while I'm here. If they do say, yes, I would be more valuable, if they do, on the other hand, say, yes, you would be more valuable to us if you were better at your job, then I'll say, okay, so what I need in order to get better at my job is formal training. I've already tried all the easy free stuff that's available via Google, via YouTube, whatever. Now I've exhausted those resources, and here's proof. Like, here are examples of the blogs that I'm subscribed to that I get every day. Here are examples of the YouTube videos that I've watched for free trying to raise my game. Now, here are the next steps, and unfortunately, they cost money. Now, what I have said to employers, too, and I've said this exact same thing when I had a boss, was, how about you meet me halfway? You give me vacation time off to do these. Like, I'm not going to burn up my vacation time in order to attend these classes. I'll go through and pay for them myself, but I'm not going to do any work during these time windows, and I'm not going to burn up my personal time. Is that fair? And then sometimes if they see that skin in the game, that may make it more likely that they'll go for it. Next up, Medi asks, "Hi, Brent, do you recommend using a parallel hint?" Generally, and you'll hear this answer a lot in office hours, the answer is, what's the problem that you're trying to solve? Don't bring me a tool and say, hey, Brent, is a screwdriver a good tool? Hey, Brent, is a saw a good tool? They're all good tools. It's a matter of what are you trying to do, and then go from there. Next up, DBA in Hiding says, "You've often mentioned that there's only one database administrator for a given company. If you're a solo DBA, how do you take restful vacation or any time off when you need it most?" First off, you train someone on the tasks that you do on a regular basis. If there's something that you find yourself doing on a regular basis, then you train other people how to take over that work, whether it's checking to see that the backups ran on time, checking to see that the patches have been applied successfully, whatever it is. Then if there are things that you do unusually and unpredictably, what you say is, this person who's really good at Googling and shows initiative, things like that. Oh, that's absolutely true. Surly Dev, that's completely true. This person is really good at Googling. They have a good BS detector. They're good at identifying and solving problems. Half of what our job is as database administrators is Googling anyway, is finding that one person who's going to do that. Then also, you want to set a time window and communicate it in advance and say, during this window, we're not doing any changes to the server. Like, the servers need to remain stable during this time when I'm gone. And then that's about as howdy, sir. That's about as good as you can get in terms of a quick, easy one. Quick, easy hits towards getting you towards vacation. The other thing you can do, and it's unlikely that the company will go for it, but it's worth a shot, is to say, hey, I'd like to hire a consultant, or I'd like you to hire a consulting company. And I'm not saying that to plug myself, I don't do this, but hire a consulting company for a block of hours to be on call while I'm gone. Like, you're going to have them, some remote DBA firm, work that week and be on call for that week. And it costs money, but that is what it is. Hi, Data Payload. Good to see you as well. Next up, we have DBA Willing to Learn, who asks, hi, Brent. I would be interested to know about one feature in SQL Server 2022 which would interest you the most and why. For me, I think that the parameter-sensitive plan optimizations, the way they were pitched, interests me very much. But what they did to 2022 compat level, they basically broke all monitoring scripts. They broke your ability to see which queries are coming from which apps or which stored procedures. That's just an absolute deal breaker for me. So I'm kind of holding back and waiting. The 2022 CTP, the way that I've been playing around with it, is such a shambles that I'm like, I'm just going to stand back and wait for the next community preview before I pass judgment. It is beta software. It's not ready for production use as far as I'm concerned. That's fine. That's why it's called a community tech preview. But the tech isn't there for the community to preview it quite yet. So I'm holding off and waiting to see what happens. But that's the one that if it actually worked as it was described, then I would be very, very interested in it. Neil asks, hi, Brent, we're a growing SaaS provider, SaaS, S-A-S-S. Best I can tell is that means that they're, for money, they'll give you back talk, like they'll be a smart aleck for money, which is interesting. I would have thought I would have cornered that market by now. We have no dedicated DBA resource, but we recognize this is something that was required. Any recommendations about the kind of things that we should be looking for? Yes, go to brentozar.com, search for sample job descriptions. Sample job descriptions, there are a couple of different types of database administrators, development DBA and production DBA, and I've got job descriptions for both of those, so that'll help you see which one of those it is that you want to hire. If you try to hire one person who fills both of those roles, just be aware that they won't do a great job across both sets of those roles. You probably don't need someone to do a great job of cross both, but at least having the two job descriptions will help you understand which one it is that you're actually trying to hire, a dev DBA or a production DBA. Sean asks, do you have any petty or ridiculous hills that you will die on? Oh, that's interesting. Petty or ridiculous hills. I think the way that most people focus on fragmentation is stupid. That page fill factor should be set at 100% in almost every case, and it's rare when it shouldn't, and people get it wrong all the time. I don't think that that's petty or ridiculous. Okay. I've got one. And oh, this is going to piss people off. If you write code standards, if you write T-SQL code standards and you say things like the commas always have to go at the end, there shouldn't be a space in this particular place, these things should always be uppercase, you are gatekeeping. You are wasting everyone's time and you are gatekeeping. Gatekeeping means that you're putting up artificial gates to slow people down from success. You're making them think that they're more junior than they are, when in reality they have great skills. I see these people, and this kills me because Mala in the community, Mala hosted this past this month's T-SQL's Tuesday blog post, and the idea was code standards, like your T-SQL should look a certain way or should be formatted a certain way. And that drives me crazy. I love the idea behind it, but it drove me crazy seeing all the responses. Your code should be formatted this way. If you put up barriers to your developers and you say, if you don't use tabs instead of spaces, you're incompetent, then you're just slowing them down and wasting their time from producing value to the end users. What I really want is I want to see T-SQL that compiles and produces accurate results. My bar is pretty low. I don't care whether you use tabs or spaces. I don't care whether you uppercase or lowercase. I use lowercase for select in here, and I joke all the time about that. But I don't care how people format their code. I don't care what their T-SQL looks like. And you know what? If it's important to you, there's a thing called a code formatter, and they're cheap as hell. They're all over the internet. You can just copy-paste the code in, set them up to look exactly the way you want them, and then your precious little feelings won't be hurt because the commas and spaces aren't in exactly the way that you want. You delicate little flower who can only look at code a certain way. How interesting your job must be that you can obsess over details like that. Meanwhile, back in the rest of the world, most of us are actually just trying to get things to run, you know, trying to get queries to compile. And I look at people who waste time on things like that, and I'm like, you're trying to slow other people down and make them think that they're lesser when in reality they're shipping code and it works. So there we go. That's me ranting and raising. There's he's format police is a great way of saying it too. Yes, format police, absolutely. People are like, it has to look this way. And it's, oh God, I don't have Spitfire. Hey, good to see you. Mike, I have buttons in here for like clapping and cheering, and so I push them and nothing's happening, and so I got to troubleshoot that before my next training class starts on Tuesday, doing a private training class for a client. But next up, Mark says, this is funny because it's kind of related, but not really. Mark says, when you were a DBA, what were your top distractors and time wasters? And it's funny because like, I would say that formatting it is a distraction and a time waster for most people. They're like, oh, my desk must be arranged a certain way. But for me, my biggest distractor and time waster was running out of drive space on servers. When managers would be like, well, we can only give you this much space on this server. And then someone would type begin tran, they would fill up the log drive, and then I'd have to go put out a temporary emergency that was just driven by somebody getting cheap on a log file drive somewhere. So that for me is totally the big one. Next up, let's see, Jim says, we have a stored procedure running on SQL Azure, brings back a list of hotels for a given city. First time it executes, it takes 14 to 20 seconds. Subsequent runs querying the same city are fast, 2 to 5 seconds, having trouble figuring out why. Generally speaking, in Azure SQL DB, you're pressured on memory that you don't have a whole lot of RAM. And so if that city is not cached in memory, the pages for that city, then it'll take some time in order to pull those data pages up into memory. What you could do is, if you're saying that you that subsequent runs are always fast, what I'm wondering is even probably if you try different cities, you're experiencing the same result. The one city, you know, you run it for New York, it takes 10 seconds, then it takes 2 seconds. You run it for LA, it takes 10 seconds, then 2 seconds. And you're switching back to New York, and it's still taking 2 seconds, but that's because the data pages are cached up or are up in cache. That's the most common one for me with Azure SQL DB. The one thing that I would say, a list of hotels for a given city, that sounds very transactional, like OLTP. And if your OLTP queries are taking 2 to 5 seconds, you have serious problems. Like you don't have an index on the table and it's scanning the whole entire thing, or you just don't have enough RAM. Next up, Carrie Jeffries asks, is there discontinued database engine functionality in SQL Server Standard going from 2014 to 2019? Thankfully, there are books online pages for that. If you search for SQL Server deprecated features or discontinued features, Microsoft has a really nice set of pages on that. And it's really funny that you ask this. I have a blog post going live tomorrow, actually, talking about how awesome those pages are and how little Microsoft has really discontinued in the last 10 years or so. The SQL Server, for the most part, as long as you stay away from features and you're only talking about T-SQL, then you're fine. if you start playing around with features, I would like to use distributed replay. I would like to use machine learning services. You got to remember that Microsoft is super distracted whenever they throw in new features. Seems like every version they'll throw in a feature and then they'll never improve it again. They'll just, whoa, would you look at the time? Gosh, got to go. And then they'll never feature improve it again. Distributed replay was the big example in 2022. Juan asks, do you have any common gotchas to avoid when adding a computed column to a table? Oh, that's interesting. Common gotchas. So let's take out the term computed. Let's say, do you have any common gotchas when adding a column to a table, period? Yeah, you could break queries if someone has an insert statement that doesn't define a table list, if you have someone that does a select star without naming their columns, if someone has a query that doesn't alias every column, and you add a column with the same name as a column in another table, then suddenly queries that were joining between those tables will fail because the SQL Server can't figure out which column you're referring to. So those are the common gotchas with adding any column. Then when you talk about adding a computed column, the most common gotcha for me is people think that they need to persist it when they don't. You almost never need to persist one. You can just create an index. Ha 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 ha, Surly Dev. Oh, that's pretty good, Surly Dev. he took the time to type that out too. That's pretty funny.
Big one with computed columns. What the hell was I saying? Big one. Oh, they think they need to persist them when they don't. Yeah, just index it instead if you're querying for it.
Next up, Itzhak says, do you have a suggested way to see how much space a long-running active transaction is currently contributing to the transaction log? I'm worried about maxing out the log. Okay. You don't want to think of it in terms of how much space a transaction is using. What you want to think about is how long has it been open? Imagine for a second here that my desk, the space on my desk here, is the transaction log. When SQL Server's doing inserts, updates, deletes, and you type begin tran, SQL Server's writing down what you do in the transaction log. Well, let's say that you do a begin tran and you insert just one row. SQL Server logs that, and then you're waiting. You're not doing anything in your application. Just at some point, you're going to commit it, but you haven't done it yet. Well, other applications are doing inserts, updates, and deletes. They're not using transactions. They're just immediately committing. But you know what? SQL Server's writing progressively in the log, and it needs to keep your space open because you might roll back. SQL Server still needs your stuff in there, so it's got to be able to roll back to your transaction. Now, that doesn't affect all the other transactions that have come in along the way, but SQL Server needs to jump to your point of the file that has your transaction in it. SQL Server keeps writing all these changes. If we run out of space inside the transaction log, SQL Server will loop back around at the beginning and say, is this space available for reuse? If the answer is no, because there's an open transaction involved, SQL Server then has to grow out the file and make it larger. That's what you're worried about, is that there's no space available for reuse. Seems like, make sure to read the thing that's up on the screen. I know it's hard. They're words. They have multiple syllables in some cases, but you are going to have to read what's up on the screen. So what you're worried about is back to the person who is intelligent enough to read what was on the screen there, Yitzhak, not like some of my Twitch viewers, seems like Avi. So when SQL Server ran out of space in the transaction log, it had to grow it out. The query that did the begin tran, it may only be using like 1 kilobyte worth of space, but the fact that they did it earlier, that's the problem, is that SQL Server since filled up all the log. Now, what you're probably going to think is, well, why doesn't SQL Server just go to the beginning and skip that transaction and then start writing again? Well, the problem is your tiny begin tran might have had several statements in it that spanned throughout the whole entire time, and SQL Server wouldn't know that without going through the transaction log to figure it out. That's why what you really want to measure isn't space used,
it's the longest running transaction. How long is the longest running transaction been held open? And that's what you want to alert on. Generally, shops will alert on things like 5 minutes or 10 minutes, because if a transaction goes on that long, you have to get a human being, a meat bag, over to a keyboard to start taking action on it. That can take 15, 20, 30 minutes, especially if your database administrator is completely drunk, like seems like Avi. I mean, it's kind of early to be drunk this early in the morning, but it seems like Avi has a tough job and he just drinks right at his desk there. So those kinds of people, if they're not sober enough when they get to a keyboard, then it may take some time in order to troubleshoot the problem. By then, you might have 45, 60 minutes burned up. Seems like Avi, oh my God, it could be 2 hours before the guy sobers up. It's just unbelievable. Poor guy really has a drinking problem. So hopefully that answers the question. Next up, we'll take Seems Like Avi. Oh, funny we mentioned that. I'll just go ahead and take his question because I made fun of him and now I got to pay him back. And now nobody upvoted the question yet, but I'll upvote the question to the point where I can put it up on the screen. Seems Like Avi asked, my friend wants to know, good on you, what are the downsides of using table valued functions from a performance perspective? It seems like they can reduce code duplication and make things easier to maintain. When do you recommend using TVFs versus not using them? I recommend using them when they're inline table valued functions. I don't recommend using them when they're multi-statement table valued functions. So if you're resourceful, you can go Google for inline table valued functions in SQL Server. And there are lots of code examples out there that show you, here's what an inline TVF looks like. Here's what an MSTVF looks like. And that should get you across the finish line. What most people don't know is that there's a difference between inline TVFs and MSTVFs. MS doesn't mean Microsoft, it means multi-statement. But once you know the term inline TVFs, then you can find the posts about it and it makes it much easier. Next up, Lenny asks, how do you decide whether to start with query tuning or index tuning when I have performance issues? Oh, it's a great question. In my mastering query tuning class, I talk about using a half-hour hourglass. Every time that I open up a query, it's usually half an hour minimum of work in order to find the right parameters for it that are causing problems, test the query, look at the execution plan, make a hypothesis as to what I think is broken, test that hypothesis by rewriting the query, then make it production quality, then document my changes to get them into source control and actually get them approved. It's easy to burn multiple flips of a half-hour hourglass on a real-world, sufficiently challenging type query. Whereas if you put a half hour's worth of work into tuning indexes, generally you can improve not just that one query, but lots of queries. So I'll generally default to index tuning just because I need to make the biggest bang for the buck as possible. Then after I've gotten rid of the normal, take a shot every time you say your name, that's pretty good. I hear my Roomba working outside in the hallway. That's kind of funny. So generally, that's why I'll start with index tuning first and only go down the query tuning path after I've exhausted the index tuning one. Next up, Mike New Mexico, I assume, says, regarding your post about SCOM the other day, can you recommend any decent guides to setting up SCOM for SQL Server? No, not at all. I think that app is a piece of junk. It's okay if you need to manage an entire data center and you don't need to know anything specific about the underlying applications. But if you need to know anything about the underlying applications like SQL Server, IIS, whatever, then it's more of like a toolkit and you still have to go build your own monitoring product. For example, if you want to know who the lead blocker is in a blocking chain, that's something that you have to go set up and configure in SQL Server if you want to. There are just so many things. What are your top weight types, for example? What were the most resource-intensive queries? There's a pile of tools, and they tell you here, this is really inexpensive because you can go build your own house with it. Well, yeah, if I wanted a hammer, I'd go buy a hammer. I'm trying to buy a house. Stop trying to sell me a hammer and a pile of lumber. It's just not a good product.
Can't understand why Microsoft doesn't like me.
Next up, Maxim says, what are the pros and cons? Oh, howdy, Michael J. Swart. Hey, hey, good to see you. Oh, my clap button isn't working. My cheer button isn't working. My laughter button isn't working. My crickets button is working. So I guess that's my new code signal there for Michael J. Swart. Maxim says, what are the pros and cons of doing encryption on transparent data encryption versus using SAN level encryption? So if you use SAN level encryption and someone does a backup, they can write that backup anywhere they want to write it. For several years now, SQL Server has had the ability to backup direct to Azure. And so if somebody does a backup to Azure, if they hack your SQL Server, they've got enough privileges to run backups anywhere that they want. They can export your data right out to Azure. It's gone. And so golf clap for encrypting on the SAN, but that doesn't do you a bit of difference once the data is outside that SAN or if somebody writes a backup to a network share. So in most compliance organizations, encrypting on the SAN is called encryption at rest, and that's like table stakes, but it's not really good enough if you have personally identifiable data inside the database, the kinds of things that if the backup got into the wrong hands, you'd be on the front page of the newspaper. TDE is a much better approach to that. It's not that I'm against SAN level encryption. It's fine. It's table stakes, but it's just kind of like underwear, right? You have to have underwear on in order to leave the house. I mean, not everybody does. I understand that Michael J. Swart doesn't always. You have to have underwear on in order to leave the house. Pants are a much more realistic minimum table stakes. So am I against underpants? Not at all. It's just that you also have to take additional steps, and that's where things like TDE come in. SQL Padawan says, hi, Brent, I just read your data model for gender post. Sorry if there's the wrong place to bring this up. No, that's totally okay. You still have a follower around here. All right, I got one. Woo! I'll just continue to read your blog and go through your training. You're the best SQL Server teacher and career model for all of us. Oh, thank you. Very cool. Long John's. Oh, there's still snow. It's June. June 20th. Holy smokes. Do you actually have snow still up there? That's incredible. I don't know if he's being serious about that or not. I hope not in June. Ooh. Next up, we have Rojo or Rojo, who asks, I want to upgrade from SQL 2016 with Sync AGs to the latest version. What's the best method to upgrade for the least downtime and stability? So I never upgrade SQL Server in place because you just don't have a backup plan. What you want to look towards is distributed availability groups. Now, I say this because you said, what's the best method for the least downtime? Oh, he is kidding. Okay, good. Whew. So you said, what's the best method? If you had unlimited time and money, you would build a distributed availability group over on the new version of SQL Server, and that's like a cluster of clusters, you can think of it. So the old cluster and the old availability group is still up, plus you have another availability group that you're sending the data over to. This is by no means easy. This is by no means straightforward. It's a pain in the rear. The books, the documentation on it completely sucks. There's no GUI. But if you wanted the best method, that's what it looks like. Next up, I want to be you when I grow up, says, I'm interested in switching to a MacBook Pro as my primary development or workbook. There's mine right there. But I have some reservations with a major platform shift. How's the Mac laptop performing? Insane. It's ridiculous. I do live streaming and recording, multiple camera inputs, PowerPoint. I'm usually uploading multiple videos at the same time, live, like as we're talking through this, and there's no fan noise, like zero. It's unbelievable. It's bananas. Are you using the M1 version? M1, I have since they came out. What VM manager? I don't host anything locally anymore. Everything for me is up in this really incredible new invention called, you might have heard of it, the cloud. So the thing that I like about the cloud, about using training VMs up there, experimentation VMs, whatever, is I never really had the horsepower that I wanted locally in order to reproduce big issues. Like from time to time in my mastering query tuning class, I have an 80-core VM that I use in order to demonstrate a parallelism issue. It's hard to run an 80-core VM locally. You know, you start to get into some expensive hardware. So I like using a VM up in the cloud that's always on. Plus, I can continuously refresh it whenever I want to with new versions of SQL Server. I've got a whole set of templates that I use across different versions. Now, I understand that that is a cost, that a lot of people don't want to pay for their lab VM or whatever. I get it. I 100% get it. In that case, I would really stick with Windows because I don't think that Intel or I don't think that Macs is the platform that you want to be on for that. Let's see here. Next up, Lenny says, who's the Brentos are for all things related to SQL Server CI/CD? That would be Alex Yates, Y-A-T-E-S. Alex Yates is out of the United Kingdom, used to work for Redgate, did CI/CD stuff over there, and now has his own consultancy firm where that's all he specializes in. Next up, Anatoly says, what are the telltale signs that your business has outgrown log shipping? Is availability groups the next step up for HADR or for HADR? That's a really interesting question. For me, the sign that your business has outgrown log shipping is people require real-time reports on the secondaries and they're willing to pay for SQL Server Enterprise Edition on those reporting secondaries in order to get it. Because, see, everybody's like, we want our reports to be real time. We don't want 1 second of delay when we run this query about last month's sales. And I'm like, do you even hear the words that are coming out of your mouth? So there are lots of people who insist that they need it, but then as soon as you show them the price tag of Enterprise Edition on the secondaries, that's when they change their tune. If they don't change their tune, then that's when you're ready for always-on availability groups. Zero Tool asks, is it therefore wise, therefore, to forgive me, because English is my first language, but don't you say therefore when you say something first? You didn't say anything first. Is it therefore wise to boost cost threshold from the default from 5 to something like 50? Did you? I have a SQL Server setup guide. It's free. If you go to brentosr.com, you click on first aid or scripts or whatever it is on the site. In fact, it's hard for you to not download my SQL Server setup guide. And in that SQL Server setup guide, I tell you how to do things like, I don't know, set up your SQL Server. If you're going to set up a SQL Server, go get it. It's free. All right, there's Zero Tools. Bless his heart. Missing the Updates Thoughts asks, hi, Brent. My friend was wondering why you don't post blog post styles or blog style posts on SQLServerUpdates.com anymore with every new CU like you used to. It's funny. You're the first person to catch that. It's been probably a year since I stopped doing it. And the fact that you're the first person to catch it probably explains why I stopped doing it. It was amusing for me. It was fun for me for quite a while. And it just came down to I didn't have enough hours in the day. And the time when the CUs would drop were often inconvenient for me personally. Like I just didn't have the time at that moment to drop and write a blog post reviewing the contents of the CUs. Because very often I have other things going on that are just weird coincidences. Like I'll be in a big training class with a client or something. So I just gradually stopped doing it. And so that's all there is to it. It's kind of weird. I may start that back up at some point because I did enjoy it. I had a lot of fun doing it. It just the timing on so many of them were really weird. No, we'll do. We'll do two more because there's another one in the list that I like quite a bit. Jimin says, do you see any SQL 22 box checking features that Microsoft included for competition reasons? Oh, that's a great question, because I say all the time when Microsoft brings out a feature, often they're just trying to check a box to say that they're competitive with Oracle. I don't think I did see any box checking. No, that's not true. Okay, generate series. So for 20 years, people have asked for a numbers table built into SQL Server. Every other database that I'm aware of, I don't know that MySQL has it, but I think every other database has some kind of way to generate a series of numbers. And so Microsoft checked that box in the funniest, most terrible way possible. If you read Eric Darling's blog posts on Generate Series, he shows the performance overhead with it. And he's also a really funny follow on Twitter, because when he's writing these blog posts, he'll show screenshots of how bad the feature is. And he won't explain them. He'll just say, you know, he'll throw in a pop culture reference and then just post a screenshot of a SQL Server thing. And it's up to you to figure out, A, what he's trying to do, and B, how SQL Server's reacting. I love those. They're like a fun puzzle for me, where I feel personally rewarded when I'm able to figure out what it was that he was doing and how SQL Server reacted, and I'll have a whole lot of lols along that line. So when he started working with Generate Series, I just could not even believe. I was laughing so hard looking at some of his screenshots out of there. It's a really poop dumpster fire of a feature there. Okay, so we'll take one other, because this is interesting. Gomer asks, would DBA Brent ever leave a higher paying job for a lower paying job? I did. So a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, I was working for Southern Wine and Spirits, a wine distribution company out of South Florida. Loved it. Wonderful people. I would still be working there today, except they didn't allow telecommuting at the time, and I had to move I had to leave the state. Erica, my wife at the time, her job moved from one place to another, and we had to go together off to Houston, and Southern Wine wouldn't let me telecommute. So I was looking at other jobs, and I ended up going to work for Quest Software as an evangelist. And I took a lower salary because I wanted that gig. Like, I was like, oh my God, I get to travel around and speak. I get to raise my image by blogging and presenting. That was an investment in myself. I knew I was making less money. I was fine with it. Now, it was a sacrifice for a while. You know, I had to suck it up for a while, but it was just totally worth it over time as an investment in myself. I have also made similar decisions. Yeah, I do too. But the problem with that, data payload, the problem with that is it's not consistent on every server. So like if you build some kind of application based on that, you can't rely on those tables being the same everywhere. There have also been times currently in my own consulting work. So as you may have noticed that I'm not doing any live training classes after October. I'm stopping selling the live class season pass. It sells like hotcakes. I was going to say pancakes, but it sells like hotcakes. It does really well. I just don't want to be chained in front of a computer at a specific date and time all the time. I want to be able to go out and have flexible schedules, do different things based on what my schedule looks like. So I am stopping teaching live classes. It's not that I'm retiring altogether. I just want to focus on recorded classes instead, because I can produce those new ones of those whenever it's convenient for me, and then take the wrapping off and go, ta-da, there you go. All right, so that's a good roundup of a whole bunch of questions there. I'm actually going to reset the entire queue for questions and let people put stuff in again. So if you're watching this live here, I'll go ahead and click it. I'll click erase all messages, just so that way they all start in again from scratch. And then that way, those of you who are in, if you want to get a question in for the next office hours, you can type that in now. So I will take off, and I will see y'all at the next office hours. I'm off to go get some lunch, actually. I was craving steak today. I haven't had steak in a really long time. And I have a really different schedule this, you know, today. I don't have any work to do at all. I'm just writing new training classes. Iceland. Do you think you'll do live classes later in a year or two? I will, but I'm going to charge per class for those. Like I'll say, all right, on April the 17th, I'm going to do a mastering index tuning class for 3 days, but you'll have to pay for that one class and show up at that one time. Because one of the weird things with the live class season passes is a lot of people will buy it and then they don't actually show up. which is kind of funky. And I'm like, well, I don't really want that. I want you to actually attend and get trained, or else you're just flushing money down the drain. I like it when you flush money down the drain. Don't get me wrong. I have cars that I would like to buy, but at the end of the day, I don't feel personally fulfilled if you're not actually learning these things and taking advantage of this stuff. All right, so enjoy, and I will see y'all at the next office hours. Adios.